Today's Teisho will be on case 26 in the Heikigan Roku. Hyakujo sits on the great sublime peak. Main subject, a monk asked Hyakujo, what is the most wonderful thing? Jo said, I sit alone on the great sublime peak. The monk made a bow. Jo struck him. Secho's verse, across the ancestors' field went galloping the heavenly horse, Basso's successor. Different, however, in way of teaching, in holding fast and letting go. His actions were quick as lightning, always fitting. The monk came to tweak the tiger's whiskers, but his efforts made him a laughingstock. So this is day two of our August session, and everybody is doing a wonderful job, really sitting deeply. This koan involves Hyakujo, Baijang, and he was a student of Ma, called Basso here, Matsu. Ancestor horse. So ancestor horse was a great Zen master who had a great deal to do with the development of the Zen school in China. And one of his students was Hyakujo, Baijang. Okay. So a monk asked Baijang, what is the most wonderful thing? And Joe said, I alone sit on this great sublime peak. So this is, that's the koan, basically. Now, you know, the koan is, like all koans involve a contradiction. And the contradiction, as I said yesterday, may or may not be obvious. So in this case, the contradiction may not seem obvious. When we think of sages, Eastern sages, Asian sages, we often think of somebody sitting alone on a mountain peak, right? Sitting alone on a mountain peak. In fact, you know, there's a whole genre of cartoons about this, right? I was just, a few days ago, I was on Facebook, and I saw somebody had posted a cartoon about some guy in a business suit with his briefcase who climbs up a mountain, and there's a guru sitting on the mountaintop, right? That kind of thing is a cliche, right? So when we think about this this koan, you know, there it's like there's nothing wrong with this picture. You know, of course, Hyakujo, great Zen master, is alone on the great sublime peak. And that might seem, you know, perfectly appropriate, naturally. Right? When we read stories about Zen masters, they often spend time in the mountains that removed from humanity. So the great Xu Yun, the great Chinese Zen master, spent many years up in the mountains alone by himself. And I've mentioned that Red Pine, the translator and Zen practitioner Red Pine, went looking for his hut, Xu Yun's hut, and found it. And there was actually a monk living in there at the time. So you know, there's this whole tradition of mountain hermits in Chinese Zen. And Xu Yun, really the greatest Zen master, some were Taoists. A power play on my part or something like that. It's just, you know, I learned so much from my interactions with Genki Roshi and Webb Roshi. And, you know, I learned things about myself that I couldn't have discovered on my own. You know, so you know, when I started practicing with Genki Roshi, it was very difficult for me to just do basic things in Zen. You know, I had, you could say, a lot of anxiety about myself. And, you know, I felt that I had not really been very successful in many areas of my life, you know. So, you know, I was invested in Zen, maybe not consciously, but unconsciously, as the thing that was going to be, that I was going to be good at in life, you know. So, you know, I was working in Seattle before I went to graduate school. I worked construction for a while, and then I also moved furniture for the Mayflower Moving Company. And while I was doing that, I started practicing Zen. And you know, actually, as carpenters go, I'm not a great carpenter, you know. I was involved in a number of construction projects where I worked with people who were like super, super carpenters. You know, I worked for this man who could build a whole house by himself, right? He knew everything about how to build a house, from pouring the footings to, you know, the roof. He was certified to do the wiring. You know, basically he would do like a couple houses a year, and he would almost do the whole house himself, you know, the plumbing. You know, he would get contractors sometimes because he didn't have time, but you know, this guy knew more than I had, you know, he had forgotten more than I would ever know. And that was true for some other people I worked with who were like super, they were really, I mean, you know, I was once asked to build a stairway, an exterior stairway to an apartment complex that I was working on in Silverdale, Washington. And it took me like days to get this done. I made mistakes. I had to redo the risers, you know, and you know, these guys would do that in like, you know, like half a day. They knew it cold and they knew the math. So, you know, I kind of knew I wasn't going to be a professional carpenter. I didn't really necessarily want to be. And I didn't, you know, I liked moving furniture. It's actually a wonderful life, you know. You load up these trucks and then you drive, you get paid, you're on the pad, you're on the payroll, you know, and you might drive all the way down to Northern California and you're getting paid for the drive. It's really nice. So I liked moving furniture, but, you know, I wasn't exceptional in anything I had done. So, you know, Zen was like my chance to be, you know, special, to be, and I, you know, I read all these books on Zen by then, and I wanted to be Genki Roshi. I wanted to, you know, my fantasy was I would go in to see Genki Roshi, and he would say, you know, this was not something I thought about or expressed to myself, but my fantasy was I would go in and he would say, you're special. You know, you have this great aptitude, this great spiritual aptitude. You know, I suppose I even had a fantasy would go, oh, my old teacher reincarnated in America, you know. It was a fantasy, right? We all have fantasies. That was sort of my fantasy. Somebody would discover me, that I had been a Tibetan master or a Japanese master in my previous life. And I don't think that's anything to be embarrassed about. You know, I mean, we all have fantasies like that. You know, if you're in the theater, you're an actor, you might have this fantasy that some producer is going to come in and go, oh my God, you're Hamlet, it's the best Hamlet ever, you know, come to New York with me and be part of my theater troupe. I mean, it's okay, you know, but I had that fantasy. So much was riding on my doing well in Zen. And of course, I was doing terribly in Zen, right? You know, the more I tried, the worse things got, you could say. So, you know, Roshi gave me a very simple koan. He said, please watch your breath. He said, actually what Genki Roshi said was, the breath with eyes, where does it go? That's like, oh, so beautiful, right? The breath with eyes, where does it go? So, you know, I sat down and watched my breath, and I said, the breath goes in and the breath goes out. And Genki Roshi rang the bell to terminate the interview. And then I tried to be special. You know, I recited poetry. Some of it was Japanese poetry. Some of it was Western poetry. You know, I tried to be creative. I brought objects into the Dokusan room. And I couldn't be present with the breath. You know, so much was riding on my success at being a person, right? At being a person. And as I failed, I became more and more troubled, right? It was just like, you know, I reached a point in my Zen practice where I had to decide whether I was going to continue and be a Zen failure or look for something else. I remember having coffee once in the morning after we would sit at the Seattle Zen Center. We would all go have coffee. And one of the monks at the Zen Center was having coffee with me, and we were talking, and I said, well, how did you get interested in this? And he said, well, you know, I was very interested in political organizing. He said, but you know, I wasn't that good at it. So I thought I would just become a Zen monk. So it was like either a life in politics or Zen. And since I'm no good at politics, I'll go into Zen. And indeed, you know, actually in the history of Zen in China, many, many Zen masters were people who had failed their imperial exams, you know. So I don't know if you know about the imperial exams in China, but you know, basically, you know, here in the United States, if you're from a reasonably wealthy family, your family might send you to an SAT test prep program, right? So you go to the SAT course and they teach you how to game the test. They teach you how to, the best strategies for answering the questions. And sometimes they even give you like information that you can use on the test. You know, so you study for the test. Well, in China, they did that too. You know, basically, rich families would spend years preparing their kids for the imperial exams. And this still goes on in much of East Asia. You know, in Japan, basically they're huge there's a huge cramming industry for kids to get ready for their college exams. And in Japan, you know, what it used to be the case, I don't know if it's true now, but once you got into college, your career was made, basically. It's just getting into college was the hard part. This was even worse in ancient times in China, you know, in the Tang Dynasty. People would have to go, families would spend all their money getting one of their kids, one of their boys, ready for the imperial exam. And these kids would go to these exams. They were actually like testing centers, you know, and they actually have these little buildings. And, you know, you would be locked into the building all day, and you would have to write poetry from memory. And so your knowledge of the poetry was required. Your calligraphy had to be excellent. And then you had to write an essay on the poetry, right? Then people would read your exams. And, you know, all of these people would fail. Only like a small, it's like 1% or something of people would pass the exams and go on. And if you pass the exam, you were going to be a bureaucrat. And your fortune was made. Your family was like, our family's fortune is made. You know, now we have this guy who can send all these resources our way, right? This bureaucrat will give all the contracts to our family, you see. So it's a terrible system. But, you know, so many Zen masters had failed their imperial exams. And, you know, they must have felt like total losers, you know. So I kind of felt like a total loser. at that time. And, you know, I made a strange decision when I look back on it, you know. I was putting all my eggs in the Zen basket, you know. And I did go to graduate school, you know, and that helped a little bit. But I wasn't really that good in graduate school either, you know. So it's like I have graduate school, but, you know, then Zen is where it's what's really important to me. But I was failing at Zen, right? And this is a terrible situation to be in. And anybody who's working with koans is in this situation, right? You know, you're investing a lot of time and energy on your Zen practice. And you're going into the teacher, and the teacher's telling you your answer to the koan is not right. You know, and you're trying, and maybe you're even reading books on the subject, right? You know, but you're failing, right? And this is a horrible situation. Or is it? You know, or is it? You know, I mean, you know, one of the most basic teachings of Buddhism is that there is no self. And this is so strange, right? If you think about Buddhism, you know, if you study religions, you know, they're like religions of the world. You know, it will have, you know, alphabetical listing of denominations and religions. There's Buddhism, B, Christianity, there's Islam, there's Hinduism before Islam because it's H before I. And, you know, if you read little blurbs on each of these religions, you know, they tend to all sound similar, right? And people who write these books want them to sound similar. You know, so, you know, we usually hold our meditation retreats at a Universalist Unitarian center in South Jersey. And if you go there, they have all the symbols of all the religions of the world up on the wall. They have the India wheel. They have the Sikh symbol. They have a yin yang symbol from Chinese culture. They have a cross, you know. They have a crescent moon, Islam. And they, you know, but if you think about it, you know, Buddhism is really strange. Because there's no other religion in the world that says that there is no self, right? You know, in Judaism, being a self is really important, right? Early Judaism didn't teach that there was immortal life in heaven. It's actually silent on that question. But many modern Jews believe they're going to heaven when they die. Christianity is big on the immortal soul, right? It's a big, big thing. Islam too, you know, Islam has a day of judgment, just like Christianity. It's called the Yawm al-Din. And on the Yawm al-Din, everybody's going to be called up and judged. And basically eternal life is Kurt or Muhammad or Ahmed or whatever, you know. So you know, Buddhism is very strange because it says there is no self. And so, you know, I think Buddhism is really a remarkable outlier in the world of religion because it says there is no self. And it starts, the Buddha was very clear about this. It was like he said, you know, actually there is no self. It's a conceptual mistake. And he said, what happens is that when we're conscious, we think that the Kurt, is the source of my consciousness. But actually, my consciousness is arising in this moment, see? And the Kurt is like produced by my consciousness. So the Buddha says that actually, like, Kurt is not the source of Kurt's thoughts. Kurt is a thought that's arising in this moment. And Sandy is a thought that's arising in this moment. And that Kurt is not the source of Kurt's thoughts, right? So that's really an interesting proposition, and it's actually kind of terrifying for a certain kind of person, right? You know, so much of our culture is about being a self and being a fully, we say, fully actualized person, fully actualized. So modern people think of the self as like a bundle of potentials that have to be actualized, right? And if you don't actualize them, that's a tragedy. And, you know, and so much of, since from the time we're little children, so much of our life is about being a self. And if you think about it, being a self has a lot to do with the approval of others. You know, so when I was, I remember when I was 13, you know, that 12 or 13 is like the, I don't know if it's still true, but it was the worst time. It was the worst time to be alive, you know, 12 or 13. Because, you know, I had bad skin, you know, I had a facial, I had acne, you know. I was a scrawny little, what do you say, 97-pound weakling. You know, I felt horrible. I felt like a monster, right? You know, I remember there was this shirt I saw at the store, which, you know, it was like a Beatles shirt. For a little while, the Beatles were wearing these shirts that, or another rock group, I think it was Herman's Hermits or something. They had a shirt that buttoned along the top and then it buttoned down the side. And they all wore this shirt. And I saw this shirt at the store and I begged my mother to buy this shirt. It was like, just buy, it was you just buy the shirt. I was going to go, I was going to get that shirt. I was going to get on the bus and everybody would have a completely different idea about me. Be like, oh, you're really cool. We didn't realize, but you're really cool. You know, we really admire you, you know, because of your shirt. And my parents didn't have a lot of money, right? So I think it was a sacrifice for them to buy that shirt. But they bought the shirt and I got on the bus. And of course, nobody noticed that I still was uncool. You know, I was so disappointed. But that's such a drama, right, that we all go through. Where, oh, it's like, please like me. Please like me, right? And if people, the strange thing is, you know, if people like you, it's still not enough, right? It's strangely not enough, right? Nobody can really like you enough. And if people don't like you, you know, it's devastating when you're that age. When we get a little older, we get a little bit more resilient. But I think this is still... this is still operative, right? This is still operative. You know, when we still depend very heavily on the opinion of others to ratify our sense of self, right? You know, when I went to graduate school, you know, there were professors in the graduate school program who had, you know, who would be who would make or break the day of graduate students. So look, if I'm walking down the hall and I saw Hazard Adams and I said, Professor Adams, and he said, oh, Kurt, hello. You know, there's a certain kind of graduate student who drifts home and just thinks, oh, he said hello. He said hello, oh, I'm real, you know. And I remember there would be graduate students who would be crushed, you know, because they'd try to have a meeting with one of their graduate student would try to have a meeting with one of their professors, and the professor would say, I can't meet with you this week. And it wasn't just like my schedule's too busy. You know, I knew graduate students who would go home and they'd be depressed. It's like, you know, I'm nobody. See? So this is sort of like the dynamic. You know, so you know, basically, we have a needy self. And Buddhism says we have a needy self because there isn't a self. And, you know, we make a mistake in our experience of the world. You know, I think that Kurt is the source of my awareness, but my awareness, this awareness is actually producing Kurt, it's producing Sandy. And, you know, the strange thing is when we run away from that, you know, when we run away from that, we feel frightened sometime, right? Frightened. And you know, when we think about something like death, you know, it's like, you know, for many people, the idea of death is absolutely catastrophic. You know, I mean, I haven't died lately, so I don't know how I will cope with it. But you know, for many people, death is catastrophic, and it's really helpful to think, okay, well, I'm going to die, and then I'll open my eyes, and I'll still be alive, and I'll still be Kurt. But you know, the strange thing is that when we practice meditation, we have this experience, right, which really contradicts this. It really contradicts this. You know, you sit down on the cushion and you begin to watch your breath, and you notice something really strange, and it's easy to overlook its importance, right? But you know, normally, you know, Kurt is at the center of one's attention a lot of the time, right? But when you sit down on the cushion, you know, it's not like looking at Kurt, looking at Kurt, looking at Kurt. It's like I'm watching my breath, I'm watching my breath, and like whole half hour or will go by and I don't even think about Kurt. You know, it's like not even thinking about Kurt. And you know, actually self-referencing just stops, or it becomes very intermittent. It's like every once in a while, my leg will hurt and I'll think my leg will hurt. But a lot of the time there's just no self-referencing at all. And this should be like a disaster, right? This should be like a disaster because the self is supposed to be the most important thing, right? It's supposed to be the eternal who I am. And you know, the strange thing is that when we stop self-referencing, we feel better. We feel better. Or generally, I think that's the case. We feel better. And you know, you're sitting down on the cushion and you're stopping self-referencing and you feel better. And after a while, you know, thoughts are arising, but you don't necessarily feel that they're your thoughts, right? This is like a big breakthrough. You know, thoughts are arising and they come and they go like clouds in the sky. And you know, usually when we have a thought, we think of it as our thought. We own it, you know. And when we own it, it triggers all these responses, these emotional responses and these associations. That's like normal consciousness. But you know, like on day two of Sesshin, it begins to be the case that we're having mental activity, but we're not necessarily owning it, right? It's like a thought arises and it goes away. A thought arises and it goes away. And sometimes it's a thought about Kurt, but even that just arises and goes away. It's like, this is like really important. It's like consciousness can persist in the absence of self-referencing. So then you say, well, whose consciousness is it, right? If it's not Kurt's, whose consciousness is it? And I think that's a little bit like saying, you know, if you're an acorn on a tree, you know, you feel like all of this stuff is unimportant. You're the important one, the acorn on the tree, right? But actually, acorn is just a little part of a tree, right? Or a leaf on a tree must feel, if it's confused, it must feel like all of this exists for me. You know, all of this was created for me. But the leaf is really just part of the tree, right? So, you know, like consciousness is part of like a system. It's like this, it's a process going on all the time, and it's creating Kurt, and it's creating Sandy, and it's creating Adam. But the system is like unfolding all the time, right? And the strange thing is that we so desperately want to have a self, right, and be a self. So much so that we have to deny something obvious, right? Which is that there's a limit to how long I'm going to live, right? And it's a catastrophe when I imagine that, you know, I'm nobody. Yeah, that's like, you're a nobody. You're a no. My father used to say, do you want to be a nobody? you know, but actually, you know, on the cushion, I'm a nobody. And the strange thing is, it feels great. It's like, oh, this is great, right? It's like you get out of your way and you realize I'm part of something bigger that's operative right now, that's unfolding right now. It's like I'm along for the ride, right? I'm along for the ride. And, you know, now it's just be part of it all. Be part of it all. You're part of it all anyway, but just let yourself be part of it all. And this is like a day three of Sesshin experience, right? It's like you purify your body, mind, and heart for a couple of days and you stop self-referencing, which should be a disaster, right? And instead you feel better. It's like I tried so hard to be special. And you know, I kept failing at it. And instead of quitting Zen, my conscious mind just repressed the whole thing, right? It's like, I'm just failing at this. I don't want to think about it. But while my conscious mind was busy repressing the whole thing, I was enjoying my new freedom. I was enjoying this freedom. You know, not judging myself, not passing judgment on things as they arose and go away, but just being present with the process, trusting the process. And this was so liberating, right? My conscious mind didn't know it, but I knew it. My big mind knew it, right? So I had kind of a split. I was a Zen failure, but I was a happy Zen failure, and I felt so free. And I kept practicing, even though I had no, if somebody said, why are you practicing? I wouldn't have been able to say at the time. But you know, it's like the self is like the tip of the proverbial iceberg, right? It's like that part of your mind is the smallest part of your consciousness. And, you know, when you're in that consciousness, it seems like the whole show. But when you begin to enter big mind, you realize that is trivial. That's trivial. Trivial. You know, it's like, you know, sometimes it's depressing, right, to read the New York Times or any newspaper. It's like the pettiness of human beings has no limit. You know, it's like, oh my God. How can people be this petty, right? And this destructive, right? It's like unbelievable. But, you know, then we get those photographs from the Webb telescope, right? And it's like, oh, this is the big picture, right? And, you know, some people might look at that and think, oh, how depressing. We're just a speck in the universe. But, you know, other people might look at that picture and say, oh my gosh, that is so wonderful. You know, it puts all of this bullshit in perspective, right? This is not really that important. And I think Zen practice is like this, you know? I mean, it's important to be a self. It's important to be a self. You have to pay your rent. You have to pay your mortgage. You have to have a job. You have a job, be as good as you can be at your job, right? It's important to put in the time, do the work. Be good at what you do. That's okay. But on the other hand, you know, it's you can be a better self, I think, if you don't cling to yourself. You know, you can be better at what you do if you don't worry, if you're not on the line every time you make a mistake, right? You know, if you can step out of yourself and realize, you know, this is not that important, you know. I think it actually helps a lot, you know. If you walk into a classroom, if you're a teacher and you want to be the best teacher ever, it's going to be a terrible semester. Because, you know, you're constantly trying to be amusing or interesting and so on and so on. And you're bound to fail sometime. And then it's like, oh, no, I'm failing. But, you know, if you just come in and you're engaged in the process, you're looking at the material with your students, you're talking about ideas. They may or may not think you're the greatest teacher of all time, but But, you know, you're trusting the process. You get out of your own way. You know, it really helps, right? It really helps. So it's like the more I tried to be a good Zen student, the worse I became as a Zen student. It's like every possible mistake, you know, tightened the muscles in my chest and made me feel anxious. But, you know, when I gave up on that, you know, I began to really enjoy myself. I began to really enjoy myself. You know, you can say, well, my job is so stressful and so high pressure, I can't afford to think this way. You know, the only thing that matters is success, or the only thing that matters is doing it right. And if, you know, that's a formula for misery, of course, you know, right? Everything good in life comes from getting outside of the self, in my opinion. And when you get outside of the self, you have a bigger life, right? You have a bigger life. It's a better life. And I think you'll be better at what you do, right? And you'll be able to deal with the life's curveballs, right? I was reading a few days ago in the paper that all of these reporters at CNN television have all been laid off because there's a change in editorial philosophy. You know, CNN has been sort of a liberal media outlet, and now the new CEO wants to bring in a more, quote, balanced coverage. And all these people are getting a pink slip, right? And they could all go home and go, oh, if only I were a better newsman, I would not be getting a pink slip. But, you know, these things happen, right? So it's very important to have, you could say, like a flexible self or an expansive self. You don't hold on too tightly because you know that this self, this is just, as it says in the Momonkan, Kurt is just a motel room. I'm just here for a little while as Kurt, right? The universe is just here for a little while as Kurt. It's like staying in a motel room. And actually, I don't know about you, but that actually makes me happy. And when I'm in that open, empty state, I feel so connected to everything around me. So, you know, basically, please forget the self, right? Dogen says to practice Zen is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to become one with the 10,000 things. So the three steps. Yagujo sits on the great sublime peak. Main subject, a monk asked Yagujo, what is the most wonderful thing? Joe said, I sit alone on this great sublime peak. The monk made a vow, Joe struck him. Setra's verse, across the ancestors' field went galloping the heavenly horse. That's Matsu, Basho's successor. So Hyakujo is Basho's successor, different, however, in their way of teaching, in holding fast and letting go. His actions were quick as lightning, always fitting. The monk came to tweak the tiger's whiskers, but his efforts made him a laughingstock. So remember that when Mumon says things like that, he's actually complimenting both of them.